The months before Ronald's wedding are trying ones for Grandpa and Grandma. Once they tumble to what's going on, they haven't seen it coming. Ronald's first mention in October of a charming girl from Chicago just arrived. In November, that the girl from Chicago plays the piano well. In December, the American girl and I have an awful lot in common, and our trips to Paris are no end of fun. And in January, a lengthy discussion of the problems of love and marriage, and how well Ronald thinks his parents have worked out their relationship. All this and more does not tip them off. Nor are they alarmed by parallel references showing their son grappling with the decision of a life work. Doesn't every young man with a year or so of college to finish worry about his future? It's not until mid-February of 1924 that Ronald's January 30 bombshell arrives. This letter is bound to be almost entirely about a girl. For the first time in my life, I am seriously considering the possibility of settling down, finding my work, and preparing myself to be responsible for a home. And several pages later, of course, I am doing quite a bit of thinking about what I am going to do from now on. The first thing to finish, schooling. After that, I don't know. I would like diplomatic service, and I am sure that I would like some branches of commercial work. Farming, though, is appealing to me more and more. The idea of working into cattle breeding is attractive. After I get my Northwestern degree, why couldn't I work with you on the farm and take the ag course at Madison in a few years? Grandpa replies, "Yours is a sensible, straightforward letter for one in your state of mind. There are no senseless ravings. You show a clear conception of the meaning of life and the significance of a choice of this nature. But is Miss Wardner of the same mind toward you?" The bulk of his letter concentrates on his son's schooling and plans. Whether you go into farming or politics, diplomatic work or literature or community service, 2 years at Madison, not confining yourself to the technical lines but to the broader principles of agriculture, will be the best possible preparation. Some farmers would consider your picture of actual farming with its intellectual and aesthetic side a mere foolishness and impractical. I do not. You are grasping something of what I mean by the farm yielding life as well as a living. Grandma's response to Ronald's news is in a postscript. "Your letter made me feel sad and glad. And also, I am glad she is not a French Catholic." Ronald's next letter, 6 dense pages on farming, is written before he has received his parents' responses. Grandpa's reply is fully as lengthy. "Reading your farming letter, I think I have something of the feeling my mother did when I told her I was going into the ministry. I thought she would be elated. However, she seemed to hesitate and question my decision. She either felt I was not smart enough or that I was not good enough. Your letter has a fine tone and shows a clear analytic mind. You surely do see the drawbacks to other lines of activity. You are not quite so clear on the advantages of farming. Regarding your fitting into the managerial work here, I do not know. You realize how much you have to learn in order to be a competent manager. However, I fear, knowing you and Trevor as I do, that you may find it irksome to take a subordinate position until you gradually and naturally step up. You must learn the truth. Only by the slow, toilsome process of self-culture does one achieve success." And his final words are, "If you become the right sort of man, get the right sort of wife, have the right sort of habits and a high ambition, I guess we can work out the details all right." And then things snowball. Ronald announces an official engagement, and then he does not want to wait till he has his degree, but wishes to be married in the fall, before school starts at Northwestern. Then it's more sensible for them to marry in France and enjoy together the European travel each had planned separately. Every letter pleads, with increasing desperation, for his parents' approval of his plans. Grandpa and Grandma's alarm grows. Events are moving with such rapidity that they're left gasping. The time lag of the mails accounts for much of this. By the time a letter has steamed across the Atlantic, been pondered, answered, received back in France, almost a month has passed. Meanwhile, they've been inundated by subsequent letters, none of which have had the benefit of Grandpa's caveats, his sage advice, his cry, "Go slow, go slow!" It's as though he's shouting down an empty track where the train has long since disappeared around the bend, even its steam and whistle no longer within sight or hearing. But the train comes to a screeching halt when Grandpa sends a cable on March 22nd. Plan not approved. Dad. Ronald responds with 12 pages. Whew, Dad, talk about the long arm of the law. It says nothing compared with the sure reach of a cablegram. But as to what I'm thinking about most, I tremble to write. He says that words on a page can't take the place of conversation with all its nuances. But there are three things he wants his father to be very sure about. That neither he nor Vera wish to do anything that doesn't meet with his approval. Your cooperation, intimate interest in our lives, and your fathering mean everything to us. That in all their plans, it is he who has taken the lead. It would be utterly natural for you to think that I am being hurried a bit, urged a bit, but that is not the case. And further, the last thing. You and I have not seen a great deal of each other for 2 or 3 years. You cannot know how I have matured, how my outlook on life has changed, how I have come to welcome the responsibilities and routines that life has shown me. My thinking is sound, absolutely. I want you to direct me as you think best about school and work. You can count on me to hit either for everything there is in me. Dad, I am a man. I am thinking as a man. Do you know what you can do for me as an engagement present and what will most thoroughly set the world at rights? Go down to Western Union and send this cablegram. Plan approved. Love, Dad. There is a time lag for these 12 pages, too. But when his father receives them, after the several letters of thoughtful planning and sped-up wedding date that were mailed to the farm before Ronald received the cablegram, he knows that he is licked. He cables his approval. It's May 3rd, 1924. Grandma is beside herself. She doesn't know if she's coming or going. She wrings her hands and wails, "Oh, he's so young, so young." And also, "He's way out there, all alone, getting married today, all by himself." She says, "It's just not possible that one of my little boys is old enough to be married." And she repeats over and over to everyone and anyone the lovely thing she's heard about her son's bride, but always with the refrain, "But he's so young." And then she goes to an afternoon church affair. A friend brings a young woman to her. She says to Eunice, "This young lady knows the girl that your Ronald is marrying." And Grandma listens eagerly as the stranger gives a glowing description of Vera. What a wonderful girl she is. So artistic, so talented, so sensitive. Grandma returns home much calmed and cheered. Vera finishes out her year of work at Chateau Thierry. Ronald, already finished with his, drives a cab for tourists to visit the battlefields. And then they honeymoon in France and Switzerland and Italy. They sail from Naples, with stops in Sicily and Tunisia and Gibraltar. When they arrive in New York in August, it's shortly after noon. They loiter around until 2 p.m. before wiring the farm of their safe return and the time they'll be coming into Beloit. They've forgotten that all business in the United States doesn't close down for 2 hours after lunch. They have practically no cash, though a year later, Mother getting Daddy's coat ready for the cleaners discovers a $20 bill in an inner pocket. Aside from short rations, the ride to the Midwest is uneventful. As they approach Beloit, They are excited and eager to see Grandma and Grandpa. They're also both a little nervous. Mother has on a brown silk dress with fur trim. She wants to look her best for her new in-laws. As the train pulls into the station, Daddy gets her a glass of water. The train lurches. He spills water all over her. Mother gets off the train stained and streaky. But Grandma and Grandpa welcome her, prepared to love her, wet or dry. Ronald takes a trip down to Northwestern and talks to his former professors. They all agree to let him finish up his work and take the final exams he missed. All but one, his professor of Russian history. The professor listens to his tale and then barks, "Young man, I have never seen you before in my life." And Ronald loses his 2 credits in Russian history. Grandpa and Daddy decide it will be best for Ronald to take his senior year at Beloit College. There will be no travel expense. Rent for a room at Aunt Ida's, only a few blocks from campus, will be much better than in Evanston. Produce and meat can come from the farm. And Lester Stamm delivers milk to Aunt's house every day. Besides, the couple now know Vera is pregnant. Better to stay nearby. Ronald sees chemistry as a useful major for the farm, as well as a study that interests him. He takes nothing but chemistry courses, except for world history. Aunt Lillian, Grandpa's unmarried sister, lives at Aunt Ida's, too. Every morning she comes down to breakfast, and every morning she says, "I never slept a wink all night." One morning in March, she comes downstairs. "I never slept a wink all night," she says to Daddy and Aunt Ida. "Well, then why aren't you congratulating me?" asks Daddy. "Congratulate? What for?" "Well, surely you heard all the activity here in the night," says Daddy. "Vera went to the hospital, and little Vera Joan was born at 3 o'clock. Aunt Lillian clamps her jaw shut, and in spite of the good news, is sulky for much of the morning. In June, Daddy graduates with high honors from Beloit College, and he and Mother and Joan move out to the farm. They live there with Grandpa and Grandma in what is now called the Big House, while the Little House, built several years ago beyond the Milk House for a married herdsman, is extended on its east side to include a fireplace and built-in bookcases, and upstairs over this space, a sleeping porch filled with windows. Then they move into the Little House. Daddy goes into partnership with Grandpa. He takes over the business end of the farm. He and Mother buy an upright piano so that Mother can play. Mother joins the treble clef music club and starts teaching ballet. Every morning, Grandma comes over. She watches Mother work, tells Mother how she has finished all her own housework and baked 5 pies and 8 loaves of bread, all before 9 o'clock. She plays with the baby, creeping up on Joan, on her hands and knees, being a growling bear. Joan screams with delight and kicks her little legs. At some time every day, Grandpa also stops by to see Mother and the baby. One autumn day, he takes a work day off, spends it entirely at the little house. He follows Mother around, watching everything she does, bathing and nursing the baby, washing the clothes and diapers, putting Joan down for her nap, taking her outside. He watches Mother do her housework and make the meals. He watches her do her ballet exercises, using the back of a chair. He asks her to play the piano for him. And even though he can't hear with his ears, he puts his hand on the wood and feels the vibrations. Mother plays and sings for him the lullaby she's just written for Joan's first Christmas. He first reads the words and then follows her lips as Mother sings. Grandpa's eyes are moist when Mother finishes. He says, "I can hear it, Vera." Grandpa does no farm work on that day. He talks to Mother about many concerns of his. He asks about hers. Mother writes back to him, or he reads her lips. He has specially requested that she not learn the hand alphabet that Daddy and Grandma use so rapidly. He wants to practice reading lips, and he wants to be able to look at Mother's face when they talk. It's a happy day for Mother, for Joan, for Grandpa. "You are a dear little mother," says Grandpa in benediction when he leaves at evening to go over to the big house. Mother smiles and feels blessed.